Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Dan Levesey. Today, I'm speaking with Dave Goss about his recent book, Abolition and Plantation Management in Jamaica, 1807 to 1838. Dave, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So I want to just start off with the generalities around how you got to this project. And your book looks really at the last three decades of slavery in Jamaica. And I'm curious what drew you to that particular time in Jamaican history, and especially even to that particular time in the history of slavery.
Okay. Thank you, Daniel. Well, this book actually, it was an outgrowth of my PhD thesis. My advisor, he is Professor Selwyn Carrington, and he did his work. One of his important books was actually on decline, you know, about the decline thesis, this debate between himself and Dresher regarding when the Caribbean plantation started to decline. So seeing that he was my professor, I'm trying to get out of the graduate school as quick as I can. I decided to do something on the ending of slavery, but not going the direction that he went. So what drew me to the book, really, I wanted to test the relationship between plantation management and productivity. Because as you know, in modern societies, management have a role in productivity of a company or not. And so if you look at the literature, historiography on abolition, you'll notice that it speaks about William's thesis, the economic reasons are the reasons for the decline of plantation slavery in the Caribbean. That's one factor. Then you talk about humanitarianism, that's the second school of thought. Then you look also on what we call human agency, the role of rebellions ending slavery. But so far, nobody's looked at the issue of what you want to call the role of management in abolition. And so I recognize that I had a kind of an edge that would have worked to be done. And so that's what led me to looking at the role of management, plantation management, in the early 19th century, to see the extent to which management facilitated the decline, or you want to say halted a decline. And that's what led me to look at this particular role of plantation management in plantation Jamaica.
That's great. Yeah. And I think it might be helpful for listeners just to know, have a sense of kind of the way the plantation is structured in case they don't know a lot about Jamaican plantations. And so management is as you sort of chart in your book, is a kind of complicated structure of people. And
right.
Could you just say a little bit about sort of the way the plantation would be structured and how that management was organized?
Yes. Well, okay. So let me also put in context as well that Jamaica also now had the in the British Caribbean, around a half of the enslaved people in the entire British Caribbean was located in Jamaica, right? So that's a significant backdrop. Now, how the plantation was basically structured, by the early 19th century, you had what we call mainly overseas owners. For example, in the earlier years of plantation work in Jamaica, most of the owners lived in Jamaica to run their plantations. They made so much money by then that many of them actually retired in Europe. And what they did now, they now had persons running, called attorneys, running the plantations, right? And so it is well documented that by that time period now, most of the planters in Jamaica are actually not real owners, but steward management. And so when I looked at that, and below those persons now are other local persons who were helped in the running of the plantations. So for example, a bookkeeper. They would hire like a bookkeeper, who again had nothing to do with the ownership, but he's hired. So plantations in Jamaica by the early 19th century had predominantly hired management staff. And so what I found from my research, and one of the findings from my research, was a very cumbersome management structure in that its owner resided overseas generally. And even that again is problematic because sometimes again, who really owned a plantation was also in dispute, because there are many cases in Chancery to decipher who really owned this plantation. Sometimes the owner happened to be a junior who couldn't run the plantation, so it was run by other persons again in Europe. And so what I found out that there's a commercial management structure where whoever decided on what you call management policy in Europe, its execution was not necessarily done in the Caribbean. Because in the Caribbean now, what we found was that the more promising attorney, they call them attorneys, because they have the legal right to sign on behalf of the owner. Some attorneys had their own plantations, and some of them would even run like 10 or 15 plantations. So there's no way you can be at all 15 plantations. So sometimes, again, it is a junior manager actually deciding on a daily policy on the plantation. And I made that point to say then that when it comes to setting managerial policy to its implementation, what I found was that there's a big gap. And so that kind of that speeded up the level of decline on individual plantations. So what I studied then, I looked at say around 20 plantations. And what I actually did to study them, I looked on their quarterly reports of these local attorneys now who would write back to their owners overseas, telling them what happened over the last 3 months. So I'm looking then on these quarterly letters which they are writing, and also the response sometimes of the owners. So when you look at that, you can trace over the period of 30 years the ebb and flow of managers in trying to increase productivity. And what we find overall, generally, is that in the early 19th century, most of these plantations had low productivity, and you could actually trace the level of decline that was constant through the early 19th century. Predominantly why? Because most of these plantations had absentee owners and, in a sense, absentee management running these plantations, and they took decisions in their own interest and not necessarily in the interest of the owners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we might want to return to that a little bit later, because that's a really important point in the middle of your book. There's kind of an important context to this, and I think the reason why you started your book in 1807 is because in that year England abolishes its transatlantic slave trade, and so that obviously is a pretty crucial part of the context in which you're discussing these Jamaican plantations.
Yes.
So could you say a little bit more about what the abolition of the slave trade does for the plantation system?
Yes, very, very, very interesting point, Daniel. Yes, and you're right. I started the book by discussing abolition, and that's why even the title of the book is even Abolition, because it is in the context of abolition that management now has to be restudied. In the Caribbean, by the early 19th century, many persons know that Britain abolished the slave trade in 1807, and there's a big dispute why Britain did it. And my book, I didn't go into the reasons, but look at the reality of abolition. Abolition meant different things to different persons. In England, the argument seemed to have been that by abolishing the slave trade, you would force the planters, like in the Caribbean, to internally reorient, reframe their management structure generally. But in the Caribbean, The planters saw abolition as a threat to their own survival. Abolition then was supposed to be coupled with what we call amelioration. And in the Caribbean now then, that was a bad word, amelioration. Because many of the planters, who again were not real owners but hired hands, didn't believe in amelioration because they argue you can't ameliorate an enslaved African because of a number of reasons. And so you could see where ideologically, whereas the owner of the plantation would more readily accept abolition and amelioration, the hired hand in the Caribbean views both abolition and amelioration as a threat to their own economic survival, because they too have ambitions as well to make as much money as quickly as possible and also retire to Europe. So the book is cast in the context of abolition. Now that Britain had now abolished the slave trade, and planters in the Caribbean were being forced to ameliorate the enslaved people to make them last longer. That was a challenge, and that is why the book is cast in that context. Where from 1807 now then, the regular pattern of buying an enslaved African for 50 pounds, 60 pounds, and then working him or her to death, and then buying another one. When you abolish the slave trade, you're now saying to the plantation owners, take time with your enslaved Africans, put in policies to make them live longer. Now, that is contrary to the management ethos at that time. And that's why I said that I had to study the ways in which now the plantation post 1807 had to change its management structure, its ideology, its practices to fit abolition. And they didn't in a general sense. But there also now, abolition also now brought with it now other additional problems, because externally, Caribbean plantations were now facing severe external threats. For example, you had what you want to call external economic problems, where in the British Caribbean, it was becoming harder to produce sugar cheaper, because sugar was also protected. And there was a movement in England to now find cheaper sugar, right? So that again is a problem that the Caribbean planters are aware of. And so they don't want to hear about abolition. They don't want to hear about amelioration. They want to continue the same old way of producing sugar in a very expensive way and still have sugar protected. But the other problem we also face now then externally was that Britain and France competed against each other in terms of what is called the bounty. There's a concept called the bounty where when sugar is sent to England, it is now re-exported to the rest of Europe. So Britain needs cheaper and cheaper sugar, right? But the Caribbean cannot produce cheaper and cheaper sugar. So already I see a number of conflicts emerging because of abolition. What England wants, what the refiners in England want, is different from what the persons in the colonies want, because the planters in the colonies like Jamaica.
Okay, we had a little bit of a Skype break there, so I'm just going to come back in. And Dave, you were talking about the challenges, because we have politicians and activists and reformers in England who want a certain thing, and how the sort of planters and managers in Jamaica want something else. If you could just come back and we'll kind of pick up where we left off.
Yes, Daniel, and you're right. 1807 changed the entire dynamics of the plantation life in the British Caribbean, because it was quite clear by 1807 that what the politicians, the refiners, the humanitarians, what they wanted in Britain was not what the hired hands, what they wanted, like in Jamaica. And so you could see that abolition, in a sense, had political implications, had economic implications, had social implications, right? And that's why I looked on the issue of management, because in reality, you find that owners and hired hands differ. Let me give out an example of what I'm talking about. For example, okay, so an owner in England hires an attorney, a prominent attorney, to run his plantation, but he's not even there because he might have 15 other plantations to run. So he depends now on his overseer. But guess what? The overseer as well, also probably he has around 2 or 3 plantations himself to run. So who does that run in the plantations? The bookkeeper who is there. And I found this very interesting story where the bookkeeper, one bookkeeper on a plantation, what he was doing, he was stealing sugar at night. So he had enslaved Africans taking away sugar from the plantation at night to his own plantation. And that's why I made the point. And this is the same person who will say, when he's sending overseas of the account, he will say, this year we only made 100 hogsheads of sugar. He probably stole about half of it. Now, there's no way for the owner to really know that all he made was really 100. And so these guys, in a sense, now were actually milking the plantation because they had their own interests, right? Another popular case, again, about the Goulburn. The Goulburn, they are probably well known in England. This particular Goulburn owner, his brother came to Jamaica as a soldier and decided to go and visit his brother's plantation, Amity Hall. When the brother visited the plantation in Clarendon, Amity Hall, and he wrote back to his brother and said, oh my God, what the attorney and overseer, what I've been telling you is a complete lie. The brother, the owner, fired the attorney the same time. So for the last 15 years or so, this particular attorney have been telling the brother a lie, right? And it was when his brother came to Jamaica and saw the reality. And that's the point I'm making here, that when we are discussing the abolition of the slave trade and its impact in the British Caribbean, yes, we know that there were economic forces. Yes, we know that there are humanitarian forces. Yes, we know that there were also rebellions from below, human agency. But we must also highlight the role that managers played in their own demise. And that's the point I'm making, that when you look at the cumbersome management structure, systems were not in place. A good example, again, I would argue, to the contrary now, is the Worthy Park plantations. Of the 20 plantations that I actually looked at, Worthy Park was the only one that had a stable level of productivity. Of course, it was declining, but declining slowly, in contrast to other plantations that were declining rapidly. Worthy Park stayed stable for most of the times. And why? Because its young owner decided that he would spend a few years in Jamaica to see what his plantation was about and to learn about plantation business in Jamaica. Most of the owners did not do that. They were absentee owners. Rose Price stayed in Worthy Park for a period. So when he's back in Europe and he hears something written by his attorney, he knows it's a lie. And so he was able now then to better manage his plantation because he knew what the circumstances were. And so you found out that in that way he was able to keep his plantation productivity levels rather stable although you are still seeing pockets, small pockets of decline, in contrast to the other owners. And the other reasons as well why Worthy Park stayed more buoyant than the other plantation owners. But the point I'm making is that we must look at the role of management in that critical period between 1807 to 1838, and to see the role that the planter themselves played in hastening their own demise.
Yeah, and this is just kind of a quick question, I guess, because I was thinking about this a lot when I was reading your book. That do you think part of this is just almost a business culture, if you want to call it that, of just utter neglect of enslaved workers and just total expectation of massive profits and entitlement towards huge fortunes that creates this maybe lethargy to want to adapt, or maybe even the attempt to be a good manager in the first place? Is it part of a culture, perhaps, in Jamaican management that causes this problem that you're identifying?
But it's debatable, because, you know, on the contrary, though, persons such as Higman, he had a different view. He argues that the planters were very progressive planters, right? We can differ in that sense. But you are correct, it's a business culture. Because remember now, this is a period now.
Right, we have one more interruption there. I apologize, everybody. Sometimes the internet just is not compliant, but that's okay. So I'm just going to jump back into this question of kind of the business culture. And so, if you don't mind, kind of maybe just starting again about how maybe the business attitudes amongst the planters and the managers affected what happened at first.
Yes, Daniel, you're correct. It is a business culture. But we must also remember that part of time period is a period when Europe, in a sense, is spreading its wings into what we now term as the developing world. And so money and quick wealth is part of the culture. Okay? Others made it in the past, we need to make it now. And there's a story I found where a father in England wrote to one of the richest planters in Jamaica, Simon Taylor, saying to him, "Mr. Taylor, how can I get my son into that culture?" Simon Taylor says to him, "Let him come to Jamaica as a young man. Let him buy one and two slaves. Then he work those slaves, enslave Africans. Then he buys two or three more slaves. He can get a job on the plantation with a bookkeeper or a lesser management staff. Then he climb the rank, the ranks, and then he can become a plantation owner and all that." So the point I'm making then, that it was a culture at that time period, that the Caribbean, that was where the El Dorado was, the period of wealth creation. So when abolition occurred, you would see why for many younger hired hands in Jamaica, you could understand why for them it was a threat. So as far as they were concerned, they were here to make their wealth as those in the past. And so you could see where management ideology now is being divided. But it's part of the general business culture in that particular period of time.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk just about the enslaved workers, and then I want to see if you have a couple of other quick points about your book that we didn't quite get to. So could you just say a little bit about what all of this does to the enslaved themselves? Because you're talking about, obviously, these managers who are either absent or just really don't care, or are actually doubling down on their brutality against their enslaved laborers. And so do you get a sense about what is changing for enslaved Jamaicans after 1807?
Yeah, good point. If you look at the level of rebellions between 1807 to 1838, you actually see them increasing, the larger rebellions. I mean, they're increasing. You can actually track it. You'll see that as the brutality increases, the levels of outward rebellion also increases in magnitude, okay, and also in numbers. But you're also seeing as well that there are also more enslaved Africans running away from the plantation on a daily basis as brutality increases. And one of the points made by some historians is that the reason one of the reasons you had like the Sam Sharp Rebellion and the one in Barbados, the Busa one, and the one in Guyana, the one in Burmese, the Marara Rebellion, as major rebellions, because by this time now, even some of the trusted, confidential slaves, such as, the drivers, the elite enslaved Africans joined their fellow enslaved people in leading those rebellions. So you could see that the brutality in that time period to make more money and not to comply with amelioration rules set by England, how that in itself conspired to bring the system down in that instance. So it's real. Even for women, even for pregnant women, because part of the argument that many of these hired hands made was that in reality you can't ameliorate enslaved people because they are idle. They need to work. If they don't work, they're going to become idle. And if they become idle, they're going to do bad things. So you could see the impact it had on the enslaved people. In terms of your latter question, there are two important things that I also found with the book, which I didn't know about slavery, and I hope that it helped in understanding more about slavery. For example, the first one is the idea of procuring adequate labor. Even when a plantation says it has 300 enslaved Africans on its list, what I found that technically, usually, after 1807, around 30% of those persons were actually healthy. If you look at plantation lists after 1807, many of them, they are now showing, and I guess part of it is probably brutality, you are seeing now where they are dividing the list. They will say, they call a name and they'll say, this person is healthy, this person is able, this person is weak, this person is disabled. So numerical strength, in a sense now, does not equate to relative strength. So when a hired hand says to his owner in England, oh, we have 200 enslaved Africans, the reality is only 30% of his promised 200 enslaved people are really healthy. And that's why sometimes the owners in England couldn't understand. But if I have 200 enslaved Africans, that's 300, why am I not producing more sugar? Part of it is that many of the enslaved persons are unhealthy, are sick, and so productivity levels are dropping. I also found as well that in that time period now then, after 1807, persons who are now selling enslaved Africans locally are what we call marrying them. Meaning, for example, and probably this is a Caribbean thing, that, for example, if you want to buy my 20 of my slaves, healthy ones, you must also take 10 bad ones, 10 unhealthy ones. So, so you can't come and buy 20 of my 30. You have to take all 30. Okay? And in that 30 that the person is taking, probably only a half are really healthy. So this issue of numbers, in a sense now, creates its own problems for managers, because they're not understanding that even when you pad the plantation with more persons that you're acquiring, and you're paying much more money for these persons, many times only 30% of your enslaved persons are healthy. And if your majority of enslaved people are unhealthy, your productivity levels cannot increase. And that was part of the problem managers recognized at that time, because the reality was that the hired hands never cared about their health and their overall well-being. They cared about pushing them to the maximum to maximize as much profits as possible.
Yeah, that's one of the things I really enjoyed about the book, was just the ways in which you showed the attempt at, or the lack of attempt of addressing these issues by the managers creates these tremendous problems on the plantation, and it really exacerbates the already kind of precarious state of the Jamaican economy to begin with. Before we get going, I just wonder, you've had this book out for a little bit, and I'm wondering what your next project is. Do you want to stay in this period of time, or are you moving on to a sort of different chronology?
Interesting question, Daniel. I want to stay in this time period, and I want to do a sequel to post-1838, but not right now. What I'm working on right now, I'm changing a little bit to something I wanted to do much earlier, right? I am looking on missionaries and their contribution to the development of colonial Jamaica. I have some missionary papers from the church I am associated with. It's called Church of God in Anderson, Indiana. And they sent missionaries to Jamaica, and they were here for a long time. I have their papers, so I'm combing through their papers. So I hope that I can write something short about the missionary impact in colonial Jamaica. That's what I'm working on right now. But I also want to do a sequel to abolition and plantation management a little later on. I also did some work for a conference in Cuba on the slave trade, the illegal slave trade. Okay, you're there when I did that paper. So I have a number of things I'm trying to do. But I think my next book would be on missionaries and their particular role in shaping ideas in colonial Jamaica. Then I return to my love. I'm looking at plantation life post-1838 and seeing if I could still trace the role of management in its continuance post-1838.
Well, those all sound great. And it sounds like you've got some work cut out for you the next few years.
A lot of work. Yes.
But I really enjoyed speaking with you, and thanks so much for taking time to talk about your book, and I hope people get a chance to read it.
Thank you for the link up, and I appreciate it.